For the past two decades, CJSF 90.1 FM has been the game-changing radio station people have tuned in to listen, share, discuss, and celebrate. From authors, actors, and entertainers to journalists, business leaders, and sports figures, CJSF has welcomed esteemed guests giving you the best in music, news, and spoken word, undoubtedly changing the sound of community radio since 2003. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded August 16th, 2023. While the Gaza Freedom Flotilla has set sail bound again for that besieged enclave, most recently 2018's Just Future for Palestine, to both get embargoed necessities into the strip and provide export opportunity for local goods. For the children of Gaza, a message of hope and solidarity is the theme this time around, and organizers say it will, quote, challenge the blockade and demand an end to our government's complicity with Israel's war crimes and violation of human rights. As he did in 2018, Canadian human rights lawyer, activist, journalist, and eco-socialist champion Dimitri Lascaris is climbing aboard. Dimitri Lascaris reporting from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla 2023 in the first half. And a snap election call means Ecuadorians will go to the polls again. This past week, presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio was assassinated, gunned down as he sat in an unarmored car following a political rally. He was not the first politician murdered this month, nor the last. Leader of the leftist political party Citizen Revolution, Pedro Briones, was shot and killed in a city park Monday as well. Outgoing President Guillermo Lasso responded to the August 9th killing of Villavicencio by, quote, declaring a 60-day national state of emergency, suspending constitutional guarantees nationwide, and mobilizing the military for law enforcement. Joe Amesberger is a Canadian-Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Poder of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Amesberger's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, Telesur English, and ZCOM, among other places. Joe Amesberger and the tenuous odds of Ecuador's political system surviving in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris at sea with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm really appreciative that you're giving it a second chance. We tried this, listeners should know, from the deck of the ship headed for Gaza from Sweden, but we couldn't quite make the technology work. So I'm really glad that you are giving me this second chance. And I wanted to ask you, too, this is a second chance for you to take this boat trip to go to Gaza. Why, Dimitri, a second time?
Well, for me personally, the first time my voyage was aborted by the fact that between Cadiz, Spain, and Naples, I joined the flotilla in 2018 in Lisbon. On that segment of the trip, I developed acute appendicitis, and the ship's doctor consulted with the ship's captain, a gentleman by the name of Jens Marklund from Sweden, and they decided they needed to get me to a hospital right away, and they changed course. Delivered me to Algiers, and within 24 hours, I had an appendectomy. So at that stage, you know, I was not able to recover in time to join the flotilla on its final leg. So this is something that I feel duty-bound to attempt to break the blockade of Gaza, and that's why I decided to go a second time. In terms of the organization as a whole, I'm just one person in it. The organization as a whole, the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, will not rest until the people of Gaza are free. And their plight today is worse than it has ever been by almost any rational measure. So we have, as a collectivity, an obligation to do all that we can to draw attention to the suffering of the people of Gaza and finally help to deliver them the dignified and humane life that they deserve.
In 2010, Kevin Nisch from Victoria here was aboard the Mavi Marmara. And in case anybody thinks this is a frivolous venture, that sailing was boarded by commandos who opened fire on defenseless people that were on a boat miles and miles and miles away from Israel. There's no self-defense that can be claimed there by any means. and killed, I think it was 10 Turkish citizens, one of them being a Turkish-American dual citizen. And Kevin shot it on his cell phone and hid the his chip out of his camera and his underwear and other places that he wouldn't mention to show to the world what how that response took place and the lies that were told by the defense forces saying that they were attacked by weapons and stuff when they parasailed down from helicopters onto the deck of the ship.
Yeah. And then, as I recall, the Israeli government, after the emergence of that video, came up with some doctored video which tried to make it appear as though the special forces who boarded the ship in an act of piracy, because that's what it was. It was a ship on international waters, which was carrying humanitarian supplies. It was outright piracy. They tried to deceive the world into thinking that there was some kind of a threat posed to their soldiers that merited the use of lethal force against unarmed human rights activists. And the whole world knows now what happened. And yet Israel continues to enjoy impunity for those crimes and a litany of others.
Why, Dmitry, then risk everything that you have, and you're a family man as well, to do this? It seems, you know, this is the sixth effort. They've all been turned away. The impunity you talk about is present and real. This mission won't succeed in changing anything in Gaza, likely. Why put yourself and your family at such risk?
First of all, Chris, I'd be clear. I don't think that there's a likelihood that they're going to employ lethal force against me or the others on the ship, because since that event, that was caused considerable diplomatic problems for Israel, even though no one was actually held accountable. It caused a severe breakdown in relationship between Turkey and Israel, which took some years for them to stabilize. And on every subsequent vessel, every subsequent journey, they've actually refrained, even though they have engaged in acts of outright piracy, and they have roughed up a number of activists and, you know, unlawfully incarcerated them for a short period of time. They did not employ lethal force after that. I think the Israelis learned a lesson. So although their behavior is outrageous and unlawful and has been on every single occasion, they've at least shown sufficient restraint not to cause the death of anyone. So that's one thing. Second thing, I recognize, having said all of that, that there is some risk of the use of lethal force. But, you know, Chris, I've had a long life. I'm almost 60 years old. I've been very fortunate in the life that I've had. There is risk attached to any challenge you make to power in this world, not just to the power of this Israeli apartheid regime. When you challenge the power of the oligarchy, there's some risk that you will suffer serious consequences. People who have, you know, been very effective and attained a high profile in challenging the oligarchy have suffered the ultimate penalty and have been killed and assassinated. There are people, for example, in Ecuador who are, you know, there was a leader of the party that Rafael Correa represented when he was the president of Ecuador, who was just assassinated in Ecuador. And if we, as activists and political activists, human rights activists, say we're not going to engage in any activity that subjects us to a significant risk of retribution, including potentially lethal retribution, we're never going to change this world. Those of us who are in a position who've lived a good long life, who are privileged, who also have the protection, I should say, of Western citizenship, which does deter people to some degree, people from countries like Israel, from employing the lethal force. You know, we have an obligation to take on some level of risk. Otherwise, we're doomed, frankly.
Well, I don't want to overdramatize this. And as you mentioned, Pedro Briones is a leader, one of the provincial leaders, I'll just use the Canadian nomenclature, but of the Citizen Revolution Party in Ecuador, who was gunned down Monday, the third high-profile political figure killed during the run-up to the elections in Ecuador. And I'm going to speak with Canadian-Ecuadorian journalist Joe Emmonsberger in the second half about that. It's just mad. Crazy. But when you say that, too, I think of Tarek, a friend of yours, Dr. Tarek Loubani, a Canadian of Palestinian descent, who was has been shot twice while he was administering medical attention to people in Gaza. And no, as far as I'm aware, nobody on the Israeli side, whoever pulled the trigger when he was clearly wearing scrubs, Tarek was, you know, I mean, things happen to people, and there is no penalty really to be paid by Israel in the long run. So I don't want to make you sound, or any of your comrades on the ship sound over heroic or anything like that. But I mean, I do want not to forget that the risks paid and Rachel as well. But Dimitri, you've been close up in Israel. Did you get across? I've forgotten now. Did you get to Gaza when you visited Israel in 2016?
No, I've never been to Gaza, as a matter of fact. I've been to the West Bank 4 times, but I've not yet found a way to get in. So this is as good as any, I suppose.
I was looking, and the ship, the Handala, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, it looks like a fine ship, and it's gaily painted. But if you look a little closer, it looks a little bit on the long in the tooth, I guess, if it's a proper way to refer to a noble ship like that. yeah. What about sea life? How are you finding your sea legs, or is that a problem for you at all?
This leg was a short journey. It was, you know, less than 2 days for us to get from Gothenburg to Sweden. And I must say that this vessel, and it is definitely showing its age. However, it compares favorably to the Al Auda, on which I traveled in 2018. It's noisier, or it's not as noisy, I should say. It's quieter. It's more spacious. It seems to be somewhat more stable. The Al Auda was rocking wildly from one side to the other. It was a very uncomfortable ride. So actually, this vessel compares favorably to the ones that I experienced in 2018. At the end of the day, though, the problem that the Freedom Flotilla confronts is twofold. First of all, you know, these things are expensive, and buying a boat. That is going to be capable of completing a journey of that length on the high seas is, you know, it's expensive, and they only have so much money to invest. And the other thing is, you know, that the Israelis confiscate the vessel every single time. You know, they have to basically purchase something that they know they're not going to be able to use again. So these are the realities we confront. But, you know, they're very, very skilled, the people who captain these vessels, in ensuring the safety of the passengers. If any, you know, question developed as to the seaworthiness of the vessel, I have the utmost confidence that they would take the steps necessary to protect everybody.
Am I pronouncing Handala correctly?
Yes, yes you are.
So you can go to handala.org. That's handala.org to find out more information than we can give you here about that ship. But if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri is a Canadian human rights lawyer. He's an activist. He's a journalist and an eco-socialist champion. Dimitri is out in Oslo today, just having finished the first leg in the Hamdallah's journey, slow and protracted by the sounds of it, to Gaza. It's still called the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. So I'm assuming, though, Dimitri, that there will be other ships that will join in 24.
I'm sure that that's the goal. I'm sure that they would very much like to see at least one other ship and possibly more. In 2018, I believe there were 3 vessels. I think it's going to be largely dependent upon how much funding they're able to raise. And if those, you know, people who are listening are in a position to make any kind of a contribution whatsoever to the Freedom Flotilla, please do that, because the more ships we have participating in this voyage, the more likely we are, first of all, to draw attention to the plight of the Palestinian people in Gaza. And secondly, to actually break the blockade. Any and all support that people can give, whether by way of monetary contribution or otherwise, is encouraged and welcomed.
Well, you've been writing about the situation in Gaza and Palestine generally for a long time. And at your website, DimitriLascaris.org, I'm looking at I just did a Palestine search on your site, and you've got pages and pages of articles, many, most written by you, but other people as well, talking about the situation in Gaza specifically. And you say that it's worse now even than it ever has been, which I find really hard to imagine because it's been terrible. I think back to 2018 and the Great March of Return, and when snipers were just shooting down unarmed people across the divide there. What news are you getting from your friends and contacts in the West Bank and others about the situation in Palestine, occupied Palestine now?
Well, let's just for some context, recall that the United Nations warned several years ago that Gaza would be unlivable by 2020. We're now in 2023, and what has happened during the intervening years? First of all, the blockade is still in full effect. Secondly, Gaza has been pummeled repeatedly in that time by Israeli military forces. There have been repeated bombardments. Additional infrastructure has been destroyed. The ability of foreign aid to enter into Gaza has become increasingly restricted. So you're talking about a truly horrific human rights horror show, quite frankly. It's a human rights horror show. You know, the level of unemployment is the highest in the world. The children who are living there have spent their entire lives living in destitution, trapped in what is effectively an open-air prison. Many of them know personally these, 1 million or so children of Gaza, friends, family members, parents who've been killed or maimed. And there's just no sight, no end in sight for this abomination, Chris. And so the people there are just suffering a trauma of unspeakable proportions. And I can't imagine the perseverance that it requires, the courage and the tenacity in order just to maintain your emotional equilibrium in circumstances such as those, when you see absolutely no prospect of being free within your own lifetime. I mean, there are people there who are older than we are, who spent their entire lives living under occupation. And the international community is effectively allowing Israel to entrench that occupation more and more every day, both in Gaza and the West Bank. The government of Israel is becoming increasingly fascistic, increasingly racist, increasingly indifferent to the human rights of the Palestinian people. I mean, there really, one struggles to find the words to describe the horror of what is going on there. And we must never forget in the West that our governments are deeply complicit in this. And that's ultimately why I've devoted so much time to this subject, Chris. I've said many times that, support for the Palestinian cause is really a litmus test of moral integrity in the political sphere in the West. If you aren't willing to stand up for the Palestinian people, despite all that they have endured, and despite the extent of our complicity in their suffering, our government's complicity in their suffering, then you as a political candidate are not worthy to hold public office. It's as simple as that.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, the part of the statement from this latest effort, it's titled For the Children of Gaza, A Message of Hope and Solidarity. It says that the idea is to challenge the blockade and demand an end to our government's complicity with Israel's war crimes and violation of human rights, ongoing violation, as you mentioned. But in Canada, it's all crickets when it comes to that House of Parliament. I'm not sure if there's even a remaining voice raised within the House against what's been happening and continues to happen there. The support for Israel seems never stronger. In fact, our politicians, like we see south of the border, seem to be competing with each other to try to prove that they're more loyal, their fealty to Israel and its policies is greater than their opponents.
Well, it's so bad, Chris, that in fact, the General Assembly under Article 96 of the UN Charter recently referred, as is its right under the UN Charter, the question of, the legality of the occupation to the International Court of Justice. And Canada just submitted a brief legal submission to the effect that the International Court of Justice should decline its jurisdiction to to render an advisory opinion. It's just an advisory opinion on the legality of what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. And it cited two reasons for this. They're both laughable, frankly. The first is that Israel has not consented to the ICJ's assertion of jurisdiction in this case. Well, there's absolutely no prospect of that happening for the simple reason that Israel knows that the outcome will be adverse to Israel's government because it's so flagrantly violative of international law, what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. And, you know, if the consent of the human rights violator was required for the ICJ merely to render an advisory opinion, then it would never render an advisory opinion. So that's just a ludicrous argument. An even more ludicrous argument put forward by Canada for why it shouldn't exercise its jurisdiction is that, according to Canada, this is the exclusive domain of the UN Security Council. The question of, you know, how to deal with the plight of the Palestinian people. Let's assume that that's true. Well, the fact is that the UN Security Council has spoken. It has repeatedly issued resolutions, including as recently as 2016 under the Obama administration, Resolution 2334, where it unequivocally condemned the occupation and the settlements and the various war crimes that Israel is committing against the Palestinian people in furtherance of the occupation. So the UN Security Council has spoken. And so one looks at all of this, and, you know, if you simply confine yourself to what is happening in Canada's parliament and the other, you know, national legislatures of the Western governments that effectively have been propping up Israel throughout this entire time, it is very hard to see a glimmer of hope. I think, however, that Israel is in an extremely precarious situation right now, not because of anything that Canada's government or other Western governments have done in terms of trying to uphold the rights of the Palestinian people, but it's because the power of the West is collapsing all over the world. And Israel's ability to impose this apartheid regime on Palestinians and also to violate the sovereignty of surrounding states depends entirely upon the continued support of Western governments. The power of the West is collapsing. We're seeing this in Ukraine. We're seeing this in the movement internationally towards de-dollarization, the BRICS attempting to finally remove the status of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. We're seeing this happen right now in Africa, where, you know, Western powers, the United States government and its vassal government in France, are trying to cobble together some kind of a West African force to restore to power in Niger, a leader whom they favor, not for reasons of democracy or human rights, but because that leader was basically accommodating the imperialistic and colonialist policies of France and the United States in that area. That attempt to cobble together that military force is floundering. You know, Western weapons have been proven to be inferior, far less effective than advertised. I see the so-called unity of NATO is collapsing. Now we're seeing recriminations between Poland and Ukraine. We're seeing the NATO chief of staff just coming out and finally admitting, after taking a maximalist position with respect to the war in Ukraine, that maybe, just maybe, Ukraine is going to have to make territorial concessions. So all around the world, and I have not given an exhaustive list, we're seeing the power of the West collapse. And if, in fact, it does collapse and we finally have a multipolar world and the U.S. is not able to impose its will upon states around the world, including the Palestinian people, with complete impunity, then Israel, quite frankly, it's over for the apartheid regime. And on top of all of this, this movement towards multipolarity that's happening with breathtaking speed, within Israel itself, there's tremendous dissent and destabilization, not really because of what's being done to the Palestinian people, but for other reasons. Israelis are fed up with, you know, the authoritarianism and increasingly anti-democratic and corrupt behavior of the Netanyahu government that is now openly allied in a coalition government with fascistic parties, you know, and so Israel is in a really, really tough spot. And I think that external forces beyond the West's control are presenting an opportunity finally for the collapse of the apartheid regime. I would not be surprised if it happens very quickly and with such speed that we are astounded after, you know, years of of virtually no meaningful progress in the defense of Palestinian rights, all of a sudden the Palestinian people, I truly believe this, Chris, could find themselves with real freedom. I think we have to do everything we can to contribute to that outcome. People should not lose hope, notwithstanding the total and utter abject failure of our government to do what is minimally decent with respect to the Palestinian people.
Yeah, well, I don't think that the role that Israel plays in the bigger scheme of Western hegemony is really understood here. It's usually presented as a religious or a Jewish question, not a question of global politics. And that the role Israel plays in that is a really integral part of everything we see. And now we see that Israel has been bombing Syria a couple times a week, at least. What they do against Lebanon as well. I can't imagine that Netanyahu would welcome a foreign war right now just as a distraction, as you mentioned, his domestic problems.
Yeah, and I think, so sorry to interrupt you, but just to really put a finer point on what you said, it's so important what you just said. You know, I the way I put it is Israel is a giant American military base masquerading as a country. It was effectively created by the West, exploiting, you know, the horrific suffering of the Jewish people in World War II, exploiting, you know, ruthlessly weaponizing the concept of anti-Semitism to squelch any meaningful discussion about what Israel actually is and what purpose it serves in the grander scheme of U.S. hegemony. It was actually created for the purpose of allowing the United States to impose its will by brutal military force on the countries of the Middle East because of their possession of vast quantities of, conventional oil. That's what Israel is ultimately all about. And if American, and that's why they prop it up, that's why they give it, it's not because, you know, the people in power in the United States government truly care about the well-being of the Jewish people. Israel actually doesn't enhance the well-being of the Jewish people. The way the Israeli government, which is falsely characterized as the Jewish state, as representative of the Jewish people, the way it treats Palestinians and surrounding Arab states actually generates hostility towards the Jewish people. Wrongly so, but that's what in fact it does. It doesn't make the Jewish people safer, but it was never about giving the Jewish people sanctuary. It was all about the projection of U.S. power throughout the Middle East. And if U.S. power collapses, Israel will collapse. It's the bottom. That's the bottom line. And we're watching the collapse of U.S. power before our very eyes.
Yeah, exactly. As you lay out, Dmitry, we're fast out of time. We didn't get to your support of Dr. Cornel West's candidacy for president in the U.S. Maybe we can talk about that the next time. But thanks a lot for coming on today, Dmitry, and keep those sea legs steady. Huh?
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Sorry we weren't able to talk about Dr. West's campaign, but I'd be happy to do that in a subsequent...
Well, that's pretty interesting the next time. And I want everyone to stick around. I'm going to talk to Joe Emmesberger about what's going on in Ecuador right now. It seems to be a presidential campaign of attrition with the assassinations mounting there. It's a real mess. But that's coming straight up. Thanks again, Dmitry.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, this past week, presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio was assassinated, gunned down as he sat in an unarmored car following a political rally. He was not the first politician murdered this month, nor the last in Ecuador. A leader of the leftist political party Citizens Revolution, Pedro Briones, was shot and killed in a city park Monday. Outgoing President Guillermo Lasso responded to the August 9th killing of Villavicencio by declaring a, quote, 60-day national state of emergency, suspending constitutional guarantees nationwide, and mobilizing the military for law enforcement. Joe Emmesberger is a Canadian-Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of